if you're going to say what I think you're going to say, I'm going to get up and run around the block.
Here it is. Well, put your shoes on. So
I'm Mick Ebling, founder and CEO of Not Impossible Labs. For the last 15 years, we've been focused on using innovative technology and storytelling to solve real human problems. With a crew of engineers, hackers, entrepreneurs, technologists, storytellers, and artists, we've tackled and solved some of the world's most incredible challenges. But here's the thing. We're just a small team in Venice Beach. The world is full of people making the impossible possible. My goal now with this podcast is to find these people, share their stories, and hopefully, together, we can keep pushing the limits of what's possible.
On today's episode, we talk to Justin Sanchez, who's working at the cutting edge of brain-computer interfaces and showing us how close humanity is to truly integrating technology with the human mind. If I put a NeuroLife system on Steph Curry and I register his movement, and now I put that on me, is that gonna now give me both the neural and muscular stimuli to actually begin to shoot better?
Mick, you gotta come back. We gotta finish the interview.
Dr. Justin Sanchez is one of the leading minds behind DARPA's neurotechnology revolution back in, when you started in 2013, I believe.
2013 at DARPA, yeah.
From mind-controlled prosthetic limbs that can feel, and we're going to definitely talk about that, to memory restoration devices capable of storing and reactivating recollections and memories. And that one we're definitely going to dive into. Yeah. And you're currently the CEO at Neurotech Institute in Ohio.
Interim CEO, but that role nonetheless.
Okay. What is the interim CEO? Does that mean, are you like, hey, we can date, but I don't want to get married? Is that you just saying that?
We helped to found it. And we're hoping to bring in a CEO, and we're kind of working through a few aspects of how we're growing that. And so I'm just kind of holding down the fort until we bring the full-time CEO in.
All right. Fair enough. So I just to set the stage with you, I want to just make sure that our audience hears that you are the Navy SEAL of neurotechnology, meaning you got the call. All of a sudden the call went off, and 30 days later you're teaching in Florida, and you got the call, and 30 days later you uprooted yourself and your family, and you're in DC at DARPA.
Yeah.
That's a pretty awesome story. And I remember in our first conversation, your response when I asked that, you were like, what are you going to do? I mean, if the call comes in, what are you going to do? Give us a little bit. You know, a lot of people have heard about DARPA, but they don't really understand DARPA. How would you, if you and I met at a bar and DARPA, what's that? How would you describe DARPA to the layman?
Yeah, the first idea that comes to my mind is when our country faces the world's hardest problems, the organization that's usually called is DARPA. It's this organization that's, you know, it's been around since the Sputnik moment happened in our country.
Yep.
And it's a place where people go for a very short period of time. Everybody's just term limited there, because they always want people to have the freshest and newest ideas and have the latest and greatest kind of perspective on the world.
DARPA is a U.S. government research agency that works on early, high-risk science. It funds and builds technologies that are too experimental for universities or private companies, often years before they become practical or widely used.
So you're exactly right. When that phone call came, again, I had this great life down in Florida. I was at a university. I was working on neurotechnology before anybody even knew what neurotechnology really was. Country called and, you know, packed up and went and did that job. And I'm so glad that I did. And, you know, this is the aspect that I wish a lot more people had the experience of serving their country in that way. Like, you know, during my time there, I got to kind of learn and see firsthand about kind of the world we live in, not only in the United States, but abroad. And we are just so lucky to be in a place where we're just afforded so much. And, you know, that freedom, it doesn't come easily. And you need places like DARPA. You need people to go and do government service to kind of help to protect and bring that prosperity to our country. And I had this very small, a bit of time in order to kind of go and do that, you know, 6 years of government service. And it was just extraordinary in so many ways.
And your 6 years is longer than most stints, right? You got the Extoto gadget duration.
Most DARPA. People are there like, you know, kind of 2-3 years, but I got to spend time not only as a program manager, but then ultimately as an office director. So I was the director of the biotechnologies office over at DARPA. And that really enabled a time where, you know, I was focused on neurotechnology, but when you get in this director role, you know, there's a lot bigger responsibility. So, you know, working on things like gene editing and synthetic biology, working on outpacing infectious disease. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, but some of the core technologies that went into the COVID vaccines came from investments from the office that I was a director of. And
hang on, this is a whole new chapter. When I think of Justin Sanchez, I think of prosthetics, I think of anything having to do with neuro, but you were working in infectious diseases as well.
We were in all of those spaces. So those, you know, those three were the core areas that we focus on when I was there. But yeah, a lot of the mRNA technology we had invested in the biological technologies office to find antibodies in very short periods of time, let's say, you know, 30 or 60 days, be able to turn those into mRNA vaccines. And if those investments weren't made, the country wouldn't have everything that it would have needed in order to really counter the threat that our nation was facing. So again, it's another kind of testament of like, why do you need a place like DARPA? You need people there anticipating what's going to be over the horizon. And if there's a problem that seems impossible, that's a group of people that says it's not impossible.
Sure.
And they figure out how to do it. And again, that applies to neurotech and all of these other areas too. You know, the place that I'm at now, Battelle.
Yeah.
It's also a place like, it's founded around this idea of giving back and doing science and technology for the betterment of humanity. You know, there's this interesting dynamic. You talk about that experience at DARPA. That's a whirlwind experience, you know, life-changing kind of experience, once in a lifetime kind of a thing. And then when a lot of people leave that organization, you know, people kind of fall off a cliff too. Like they never are able to find a place where they can do science and technology on the level that they did there, or find a way that had, you know, that deep meaning of like you're giving back in some way. I was so fortunate to land at a place like Battelle, where, you know, 90-plus-year-old company formed out of a family trust, where this guy, Gordon Battelle, and his mother were like, okay, we have a family fortune. We want to give it back. We want to do science and technology for the greater good. All the work that I do, like all the high-end science and technology and health and national security and environment and infrastructure, all of the revenue that we make, we reinvest it either in more science and technology or STEM education. Like the big part of our philanthropic mission is to train the next generation of scientists, and maybe even kids that would have never had a shot to do science and technology, that they can get the education that they need in order to go and try something impossible and actually make it a reality. So I really wanted to just kind of share that with you, because I know that you believe in those kinds of things too, of like, go and make it whatever way that you can. Well, you know, some kids can't. And, you know, if we can do some small part in giving those kids an opportunity, then like, that's a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
That's amazing, Justin. I love that. And I agree. Sometimes you have these moments in your life or in your career, and it sounds like DARPA was one of those things, where once you leave and you exit it, you're constantly looking for that purpose and that meaning. And you're right. The mission of Battelle sounds very similar to Not Impossible, which is, you know, we create what we call technology for the sake of humanity. And it's in Ohio State, right? It's at Ohio State University?
Right next door to Ohio State. Okay. Yeah, so the campus of Ohio State is right next to the campus of Battelle. So also an interesting dynamic there, where you can kind of get, you know, the best of what Battelle brings, the best of what OSU brings to the table. Sure.
I think one of the most, I would think, revolutionary things that Ohio State has accomplished in the history of its existence, and I know that it's been around a while, is that it has not only internally but externally appropriated the article "the," is that you cannot right. you can't say Ohio State without the Ohio State. Jake, who's one of our guys here, was doing all the prep for our conversation, said that the spell check would correct it to the Ohio State.
Yes.
That's just, I love that. That's amazing.
That's pretty amazing, you know. Get the confusion out of there. It's the Ohio State, you know.
So, all right. So we were talking back in 2018. You joined DARPA in 2013. And then in 2015, our friend Johnny Matheny received and used the MPL. But hang on, really, there was this guy that we were cracking up when we were listening to this. I'm going to play this for you. And we're going to play Name That Tune, right? We're going to name that person.
Okay, or, no, awesome.
Sorry, it's not Name That Tune. It's This Is Your Life. Okay, here we go. Ready?
Okay.
Let's see. I'm going to see how many words it takes for you to recognize
who
this is. I think you'll get it. Here we go.
Now it's 150 years later. We give him a plastic stick with a hook on it. He said, that's going to stop. You can't pick up a grape with a hook. You can't pick up your three-year-old daughter
that's
with
Dean
a hook.
Kanan.
You can't open a door with a hook.
You can't pick up a grape with a hook. You can't open a door with a hook.
He's got that accent.
He's just like,
the Northeast accent.
Shut
right?
up and get to work and give me a prosthetic, damn it.
That voice you just heard is inventor Dean Kamen. DARPA brought him in during a program called Revolutionizing Prosthetics with one goal. Replace the hook with something that moves and feels like a real arm. That work helped lead to the advanced Luke arm, and alongside Kamen, DARPA recruited neuroscientist Justin Sanchez to help solve the next part of the challenge. How do you actually control an arm like that naturally?
So just so everyone that's listening is clear, we figured out, now I'm being the inclusive we, aka Justin and his team, figured out with Johnny how to create the Luke arm. That evolved to another group that was working on the MPL. And now we figured out a way, and that was to the biomechanics of that allowed the arm to do things in specificity that wasn't able to be done before. Amazing, incredible. But you guys went further, and now you actually made it. So you connected the movement of the arm to the brain with a neural network. But now you've created it so you can actually feel heat, you can feel sensitivity. So it's not just a mechanical action, but it's a feeling action. Talk about that for a second, because that's something that I think a lot of people are going to give like the puppy look. We're like, what? Hang on a second.
Yeah, exactly. So you broke it down perfectly, right? So the whole idea behind doing this work was near natural control of prosthetic limbs. And if you want near natural control, you've got to interface with the nervous system somehow, some way. And, you know, you can either do that in your peripheral nervous system. So let's say like your nerves and, you know, muscles and let's say your limb, or you can also go back directly to the brain. And so for those of you who are not neuroscientists that are out there, there are parts of your brain that control the movement. It's like in one little portion on the side. And then there's an other portion of the brain that are involved in the feeling or the sensation, again, a little bit, you know, next to it. And what you do is you put sensors and stimulators in those parts of the brain. And these are very micro level kinds of sensors and stimulators. And they bidirectionally send information in and out of the brain. So like you just said, we started, you know, bit by bit, enable a person who's either been paralyzed or lost a limb to think about controlling this limb, just do the control. Once you do that, add on the sensors, and then the problem's hard, but in reverse. So send anything that you're sensing in the environment and turn it into signals that the brain can interpret as the feeling of sensation. So we did both of those parts. And again, being DARPA, we didn't just stop with just the normal movement and sensation. We said, can you feel infrared? Because, you know, our hands can't necessarily feel infrared as you normally would. Or let's say you're flying a virtual drone. Can you put sensors on that drone and allow a person to feel what those sensors are actually picking up in the environment?
That's amazing.
And it turns out that you can. And, you know, it speaks to the great adaptability of the brain and the body of the nervous system. Like your brain and your nervous system is the ultimate adaptive system. give it inputs and outputs, whether they're the normal ones or not, and your brain will figure out how to use it.
Justin, you're touching upon something that is very near and dear to us, which is this concept of neuroplasticity. And years ago, we created a way for the deaf to experience music through their skin as the receptor. So the skin was acting as the eardrum. And that was the first kind of aha moment for us when we saw that you don't see with your eyes or smell with your nose or hear with your ears or feel with your skin, as you just proved with what you created with a prosthetic being able to feel. You don't do that with your skin. You do that with your brain. And we can circumnavigate and bisect and go all different directions to get around the quote conventional means of getting to the brain. But once we get to the brain, then what we experience from a taste and touch and smell and feel perspective, it's wide open.
We often talk about muscle memory, but muscles don't remember anything. All learning, coordination, and adaptation happens in the brain. Once you understand that, prosthetics stop being mechanical devices and start becoming neurological ones.
But Meg, you know, there's another important point in all of this too. So years and years ago, there were scientists doing experiments and things like this. So there are examples in the literature. Again, I encourage anybody that's listening here, or even if you're a scientist too, go read the old literature. There's been a lot of stuff that's been figured out in the past, but there's like non-human primate experiments where they have monkeys using a rake to kind of grab, let's say, food. And you can show that, like, if the animal is using its own hand, you can see their brain, it fires in a certain way. And then when you start using a tool, their brain will incorporate that tool into its cognitive space too. So again, when we talk about like plasticity and things like that, just kind of in the abstract, there is rigorous scientific work that's been done, like, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, that showed and actually measured those changes in the brain. So again, the proof is out there, and we know that it's something that the brain does every day.
Neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to adapt to new inputs. Give it a tool long enough, and the brain begins to treat that tool as part of the body.
To that end, give us an update on what's going on in the world of prosthetics now, because it's been 7 years since we spoke. A lot of wonder under the bridge. What's happening within the prosthetic space?
I feel like the last 20 years of my life, 20 plus years, right? I started in neurotech when we were just asking the question of, is it even possible? I've done so many demos on so many fronts. I'm really focused on how do we really take that neurotech and really get it out into the world. And the tech that I'm working on at Battelle is we have a wearable technology. It's a high density electrode array that, let's say, fits on your forearm and can read out nerve and muscle activity, and we can write in nerve and muscle activity to control the hand.
NeuroLife is a wearable neural interface. It reads nerve and muscle signals from the body and can also write signals back in. That means it can restore movement, guide rehabilitation, and potentially accelerate learning.
So why is that important, or why would anybody care about that? So,
we're gonna get to that, why it's important, but just to take that down to Mick Ebling's simple terms here, you've got a sleeve that can now, if someone's arm is paralyzed, if someone's arm does not function, you now have a sleeve that they put over. It's non-invasive, and you've created, or you're creating, a way for them to think about the movement of that hand, of that arm, that is now going to be stimulated through the thinking. It's wireless, a wireless way for that hand to move.
Yeah. And
what's that product called?
Yeah, it's called NeuroLife. So anybody can go online, type in Battelle NeuroLife, and you can see this technology. But Nick, you're exactly right. Again, it's like, think of like a spandex kind of a thing that has all these kind of sensors and stimulators in it. Super comfortable, and it's a direct interface to the nervous system. You think about moving, even if you have diminished neural signals. Let's say you've been injured by a stroke or something, and only a little bit of the signal comes down from your brain to your arm. The system picks up those signals, can augment those signals, and can facilitate your hand moving in the way that it did, you know, before you had your injury.
The ramifications of this are massive. You think about injuries, if you think about stroke, if you think about all the different things. But where my head goes to is something that's even more dramatic. And Andre, who's in studio with me right now, and I were talking about this. If you can imagine that NeuroLife, not just as a sleeve, but as a full bodysuit, you could take someone like me who can't dance, and I could be incredible. I could be incredible. I just need to watch pictures, watch film of Michael Jackson or people like that. And now I'm dancing the same way. That's what you're telling me, right?
You're exactly right. The idea is you can take a novice and you can write into their nerve and muscle the right physical movements so that they can learn to, let's say, swing like a golf pro or dance like Michael Jackson or those kinds of things.
I was just taking the piss. I was just kind of like messing here, but that's crazy. So that you actually, that was in 2020, you already were articulating programming muscle movement to be superior to what you currently have in you,
or to
be
practice,
able to perform at a higher level.
We know the muscle memory thing. So we've all done sports, I'm sure, at some point in our lives, and you know you get good by doing it a million times, right? And your coach typically gives you feedback on here's how to improve your swing, or here again, or if you're a dancer, here's how to dance, you know, here's how to do that move a little bit better. This technology is all about writing directly into your nervous system the coaching, and through algorithms and AI and, you know, sophisticated kind of programming, you can maybe make that coaching a lot at the beginning, but then as you learn how to do it, you can titrate off that coaching so that it's more you and less of the algorithm or the system doing it. And that has huge implications for you and me as consumers, right? We would all love to learn things faster or physically move or recover better or whatever. And I think that there's a huge market out there for that.
That would be the understatement of this conversation.
Yes. And in addition, again, 2 points. The medical thing, there's a huge need right now. I mean, just think about physical rehabilitation after stroke or paralysis. We all know a loved one who's gone through that kind of physical kind of movement. Like, how much does it actually work? How long does it take? Like, the pain points of kind of going through all that, it's tough for the person giving the therapy. It's tough for the person receiving the therapy. There has to be a better way. And this NeuroLife system, we've done some initial testing with that. It's pointing in the direction of this is an entirely different way of kind of thinking about rehabilitation. And, you know, you get the 2-for-1 out of it. You solve the medical rehabilitation. Everything you learn from the medical rehabilitation has a huge implication in the consumer world for people like you and me that don't necessarily need it medically, but might want to do something else. But Bick, back to the point of where's the market? For actually the marketplace for actually doing this. We've had this technology for like 10 years now. The amount of effort, time, and work that it takes to kind of figure out all of these kind of, I don't know how to describe it, is kind of the nuts and bolts of it. It's a battle every single day.
So I get the prosthetic, it being a battle on prosthetics, because if you take the total population, how many people need prosthetics? But when you're talking about something, and I want to double click on this with you for a second. When you just said that you could make me golf better, you could make me shoot the basketball better, you can make me throw, you can make me perform better, that seems like that is a market that would go gangbusters. What's the price point for NeuroLife? Like, what, that must be the major limitations.
That's the work that we still need to do, right? We've had these advanced prototypes. We've shown what it can do. Has it been productized yet? No, you know, not to the degree that it needs to in order to be, let's say, a consumer device on that level, or even in the medical domain. I mean, there's still a bunch of work that needs to be done there. And it's just so interesting.
Hey, Justin, can I ask you a question? So Can this both register and record as well as project?
Both. Both.
So if I take this, mm-hmm. I just went to a Golden State Warriors game the other night, and I was telling the team about this. I got to see Steph Curry play. He's a freak. There's the only way to describe it. He's a freak. There's no reason that someone his size, he's just a freak. He's just incredible. If I put a Neuralife system on Steph Curry and I register his movements, and think of any elite athlete, go back in time, I have that as a recorded signal. It's a memory of what Steph Curry does. And now I put that on me, and I was a decent shooter, but I was knowing Steph Curry. Is that going to, or let's say I was a horrible shooter. Is that going to now give me the both the neural and muscular stimuli to actually begin to shoot better?
What the person's going to experience, right? The recipient of, let's say, Steph Curry's muscle and nerve activity, that person will experience, here's what works for Steph Curry. And yeah, all of our bodies are so personalized, right? And so unique, that person will have to determine, does that work for them? Or maybe there's some element of it that works for them.
Are they making that decision cognitively? Are they making that cognitive decision? Well, this works for me, this doesn't work for me?
Well, this is a part of the work that still needs to be done. Like we don't know on the broader scale of, let's say, all of these things, let's say golf and football, you know, track, you know, basketball, whatever it may be. We don't know yet. But what we do know is that we've got the interface and we've got the algorithms, the adaptive algorithms that can, let's say, start with Steph Curry's nerve and muscle activity, see how that works for the individual using it, and then co-adapt those activities that bring out the best performance in whoever's using it. And that is a central point, I think, in a lot of what we're talking about here. These technologies now allow the merging of those algorithms with the neural interface to adapt over time so that you can get the best of the machine and the best of the human for the specific goals of whoever is using it. So it's not like a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. It's not like going and buying your microwave. Everybody buys essentially the same microwave. No, it's not that. We are talking about personalizing your neural interface to achieve whatever goal that you may have, whether it's stroke rehab or whether it's, you know, sports performance.
So give us some other examples. So sports, obviously, I'm fascinated with, but rehab, whether you have stroke or any type of paralysis, does this work for someone who is a paraplegic or quadriplegic as well?
Yeah, and we've done a lot of scientific work on that, published papers, peer-reviewed papers, and just let me flip-stop that for a quick second. The demo is great. Rigorous science is also super important. We've got the track record to show that you can do that. So yes, in people living with paralysis, we have placed the sleeve on. And even if that signal is impaired from, you know, going through their spinal cord, if there's even the tiniest residual amount, we have been in those scientific papers able to use that residual amount, augment it, and facilitate functional increases. When that person, you know, if they were just practicing on their own without this, they would never be able to achieve the level of performance that they were in those cases and using that technology.
That is fascinating. That is baffling. Are we getting to the point? I remember when we were doing this, there was a toy that you could buy it off of Amazon. You could buy it from wherever.
Yeah.
You'd put on this little headset, and then in front of you was a tube, and the base of the tube was
a fan.
Yeah,
I remember that. Yeah, make the and little ball go up and down.
And it was a ball,
right?
and the Yoda voice would come on and say, "Use the force." Right. And then you would work at trying to hover that ball in the tube, and that was the whole game.
Yeah.
It's been 12 years. Where are we at right now in terms of pedestrian consumer neural interfaces that allow us to do even the most pedantic and simple things like, you know, play with a ball in a tube, to obviously the more expressive and scientifically rigorous things like the things you're talking about with Neuralife? Where are we at in the continuum of just basic neural technology for basic actions?
So when it comes to the brain, is they putting something on your scalp or on your head for your brain. Nothing really has changed on that front. And it comes back to, why haven't people made progress? The biophysics, you got these miniature signals deep in or on the surface of the brain, and they got to transmit through the skull and the scalp and your hair or whatever else is in between you and those signals. And with today's sensors and technologies, those just cannot contend with that. Now, here's the one difference, though. When you put NeuroLife on, let's say, the forearm, our sensors are right adjacent to the nerves and muscles. They're just right underneath the skin. There's no skull or, you know, a thick scalp or a lot of hair to interfere with that. So in that case, it's a lot easier for us to get high resolution signals that we can use signal processing to get actual nerve activity from. Okay. So when it comes to the head, not much has changed. You're still just doing these kind of different brain states as opposed to very high resolution kind of neural, you know, signals non-invasively. In the periphery, though, different story. With the right array of electrodes or the right signal processing, you can get high resolution neural activity, and we've figured out how to do that. So again, for any,
you've talked a lot about, again, this conversation started with prosthetics, and it has been almost entirely on neural activity. The way that you think about the extension of or the rehabilitation of a human or the recovering of actions of a human who like Johnny lost a limb, everything resides in the neural work that you at DARPA and now at Battelle are doing. We talked a second ago about Steph Curry. We talked about you putting on stage. The word muscle memory is used when people talk about actions. It's used a lot for athletics, right? Muscle memory of free throws or of pitching or what have you. But muscles don't have memory. Muscles are just flesh. It's the brain that has the memory, and it's that action which brings us full circle around to, and now we're getting, this was all a setup for the conversation about the work you're doing in RAM, which is restoring active memory. Talk a little bit about that work. Obviously, the premise, you know, it's easy to pull the thread and see what you did at DARPA, what you were studying, what you did at DARPA, what you're doing at Battelle, but pull that thread and explain to everybody what RAM is.
Yeah, so that RAM was a DARPA project. It started during that time that I was there. And the idea was military personnel come back from service. They might sustain a traumatic brain injury in service of the country, and then they can't form and recall memories anymore or have a difficulty doing that. You just think of it, put yourself in the shoes of that person that goes to protect the country. They get hit in the head for whatever reason, and then they can't remember their loved one. They can't, you know, do all the things in their normal life that requires memory. So we set out during that time, say, okay, just like we did for movement and sensation, let's build a direct neural interface that helps a person form and recall memories. All right. So now for everybody listening, there's a very different part of the brain that's involved in this. So it's in the side part. It's called the temporal lobe. And there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus that's involved in all of that. And we set out to develop a direct neural interface that goes into the hippocampus or near the hippocampus and can interpret when a memory is being formed and can stimulate when a memory needs to be recalled and every variant in between there.
And as far as the machine that is recognizing that it's a memory as opposed to picking up a grape or picking up a raisin, how do you distinguish between what's a memory and what's a physical action that the brain is thinking
of? Yeah. So now I ask you and the audience, step into our shoes when we were doing this, okay? So we set out to do this impossible thing, right? Form a memory prosthesis. There are multiple different types of memory.
Which is, by the way, when we first talked about this, you called it prosthetic memory. And I just remember being blown away about how that so perfectly describes what it is you're delving into.
Yeah, it's this device, right, that helps the memory. So there's a lot of different types of memory. There's declarative memories, like memories of an algorithm that identifies that, you know, been the right neurons at the right time. When are they firing and when are they not? And how are they related to that image? And once you start to make those relationships, then you start to say, okay, I know what the neural activity is for, let's say, image of a tree. Can I provide that neural activity back into the brain? And then ask the person, what did I want you to memorize? Okay. And if you stimulate their hippocampus and they come back and they say a tree, then you know that your system actually worked for helping that person to form and recall a memory. So again, I'm boiling it down into its kind of most, you know, elementary.
So it is literally, it's A-B testing. You test, yeah. you say tree, you read tree. You say tree, you read tree. You say ball, it's different from tree. Now you recognize the distinction between those two. And now you've made the distinction between ball and tree.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, in humans that have a brain interface to do that. And there was just so much that was unknown at that time that we had to just do the basics and
I get the registering the difference between something. Mm-hmm. Following you on that. But let's now go into the concept of prosthetic memory, which mm-hmm. is recording memories. And yep. I'm going to say that again.
Sure.
The concept or the act. Are we already doing this? Is this already being done?
It was done years ago where we record memories,
but can you play those memories? Well, I'll never,
yeah,
I'll come back
you
to
can
the
play
question
them back.
That, of course.
But we
can
have
you
to be,
stimulate yeah. that back in me the same way you can
yes.
stimulate the act of me shooting like Steph Curry? That
well,
you're
I'm going to blow your mind.
Memory.
I'll blow your
you
mind.
Already have. It's too late, but do it some more.
You can not only do it for one person, but you can do it for another person too. But let's be precise.
Hang on, Justin. Hang on. This is good. So can you record your memory, register that, then you have Alzheimer's, you have dementia, you have a TBI, and you can play that back so you can now recollect, you can have that memory played back to you?
So for declarative memories, memories of facts, the work that we did at DARPA, and there's people that publish on this work too, yes. You can write those memories back into the brain and a person can tell you, say, that's what I needed to memorize. And moreover, those neural codes could, this is another experiment that we worked
okay,
on.
If you're going to say what I think you're going to say, I'm going to get up and run around the block.
Here it is. Well, put your shoes on. So take person A, show them a series of declarative memories, the images, you know, that you want them to memorize, record those neural activity. Then take those neural codes and adapt them to person two, put them in a separate room that he's getting up already, right
I'm
in the neural
here.
Code.
I'm out of here.
They're doing a lap around the block. Mick, you got to come back. We got to finish the interview.
Okay, hang on. So you're saying we can record from person A.
A.
Play it back for person A. They then have that memory where they had lost it before. But you can now record for person A, play it for person B, and person B can have that
and
memory.
And ask them, say, what image did we want you to recall? And more often than not, they will recall the memory that was being written back into their brain. Again, it's simple right now, just declarative memory. Again, when everybody listening, again, we're not talking about all kinds of memories, just one very, very small aspect. And, again,
and declarative meaning a word or a concept.
Yeah, a
or,
fact, a word or an image or something like that.
Let's talk a little bit about the ethics around recording memories and the concept of, and I never would, you know, unless you actually have started to pay attention to this, the concept of recording memories begs the question of, well, if you can record memories and you can play back memories, then you can also hijack those memories, which introduced this concept of brain jacking and being able to, when you put memories back into people, having them being altered in some capacity, which sounds very, you know, rogue
dystopian and
dystopian. But talk a little bit about some of the things that you've contemplated as it relates to the ethics around recording memories.
Yeah. So as in all of the what we've talked about today, we've often gone back to first principles. And you know, this one thing I'd like to share with your audience is, especially people taking things that are impossible and making them possible, anybody who's doing that is likely working on a powerful technology. And, you know, kind of like those old cliches that are out there, like if you're working on powerful technology, there's responsibility that goes along with that. Uh-huh. Whether you're a scientist or non-scientist, you must have a responsibility. And when it comes to neurotech, it's even more true. And when I was at DARPA, and even after, I've always taken the neuroethics part of it very, very seriously. And you know, to the point of, you know, at DARPA, we had an advisory panel that you kind of helped on the ethics, and you kind of esteemed scholars that helped us to kind of think through the implications of what, you know, was being done. Here's what I often boil a lot of that feedback down to. Character, consequence, and consent.
Okay.
If you preserve at least those three C's, it is kind of called the three C's in kind of the ethics world, you can stay on the right path. You know, the consent is the easy one, right? A person needs a consent to whether they're having their brain recorded or stimulated or whatever it is, you need to have that. And even in like our everyday life in the consumer worlds that we live in now, you know, people consent to a lot of stuff even without even reading, you know, what they're consenting to. So, you know, I guess I would argue that while today we're talking about our brain signals and the implications of tapping into them, in our everyday lives, we are giving up a lot of our freedoms and a lot of our data and a lot of our behaviors to the consumer world without even thinking twice about it. So again, I'm not trying to minimize the situation. I'm trying to bring context into powerful technologies. We got to be careful. Consent needs to be like a big part of it. And think about that consent, not only in the terms of brain activity, but what you're already giving away today to help you to figure out, well, how far are we away from that dystopian world? Or, you know, is this something that is kind of more near term to us than we really think?
The fact that you now have the ability to transmit muscle memories and actions through a wearable technology is, to me, it's such an incredible harbinger of good, of like what's going to be possible for the future, not only for the rehab, but also for performance, for also just our acceleration as a species to be able to do more and encompass more. And, you know, I am sure there's lots of ways that take it down dark paths, but I think that there's probably more good than bad that can come out of that. And I think that back to your three C's, if we protect those from an ethical perspective, I think it's really remarkable what's going to happen in the next 10 years.
Yeah, the possibilities are really huge and without a doubt, much more good for neurotech coming in the future. Mick and team, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. What you guys are doing is just absolutely amazing. And I can't wait to see what Not Impossible is going to do next.
Justin, you basically said exactly what I wanted to say to you, which is I am so honored to have been able to have another conversation with you. The work you're doing, your perspective, your passion is just so out front in terms of how committed you are to your country, to this technology. And it's an honor to be able to talk to you. And I thank you. I thank you. And I can't wait for our next conversation. And that wraps up another episode of the podcast, where we talk to some of the world's most fascinating people, transforming the impossible into the non-impossible. A big thank you to Justin Sanchez for walking us through how brain-computer interfaces are moving from science fiction into real working technology. It's conversations like these that remind us that innovation isn't something that just suddenly arrives. It's something we're already building, thought by thought by thought. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platforms. And remember, everything that's possible today was impossible first. So if that is the case, that means everything that's impossible today is on that same trajectory of going from impossible to possible. We all have the ability to make the world a better place. That is not impossible.